Okay, I'm Kara Buick, and this is May 1st, 2004, with Rosemary Burke. Okay, I said that right. And we're in Salt Lake City at the 71st EVAC reunion. So we'll just start with where you grew up, where you're born and raised.
I was born in Valley Stream, New York, and my parents moved there when I was a year old to Bradford, Pennsylvania. And I lived there until I went into nurses training in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1964, and that was a diploma program. And when I was a junior in nurses training, my pediatric affiliation at the Children's Hospital there, I met students from other schools throughout the western part of Pennsylvania who were in the Army Student Nurse Program. And the thing that caught my attention was when they were senior students, they were going to be paid $100 a month. And all you had to do was serve 2 years after you passed your state boards, after you had graduated from nurses training. And since I had no money, it certainly sounded good to me. And one of my classmates wanted to do the same thing. And so we went in on a buddy program. You had to enlist, and you were, I'm going to say, enlisted by a nurse recruiter as a PFC, which you were during your final year. And when I graduated, then that ceased to be. And once I passed, I took state boards in December of 1967, and I was notified on January 25th, and I was commissioned as a second lieutenant on February 14th in 1968. And within 2 weeks, I was on my way. Well, I should say it was less than 2 weeks. Within 1 week, I was on my way to basic training at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. In terms of wanting to be a nurse, I guess by the time I was 10 years old, I had decided that that's what I wanted to do. And I was a Girl Scout. At that time, I was an intermediate Girl Scout. And we had learned first aid, and just that initial first aid training really, you know, I'm going to say, increased my interest in nursing. And as a senior scout then, we also would have a project where we would actually paint coffee cans, fix them all up, bake cookies, and take them to the county home for the aged. This was a project every year. But also I volunteered 1 day a week in the it was a nursing home that was connected with a small community hospital. And I was also a candy striper. And I was fully, you know, determined that this was going to be what I want, you know, what I was going to achieve. And when I first worked on the ward as a candy striper and was going around to the patients, I felt like I had arrived. This, you know, truly was what I was destined to be. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. And I couldn't afford to go to a collegiate program, and I wasn't eligible for scholarship. Well, there was one scholarship available, and I didn't receive it. And I was able to get a loan for the School of Nursing, and I made it through. And that's pretty much how I ended up really in going into nursing and how I was first introduced to Army nurses.
What did your parents think about you as a nurse? Did they like that idea? Did they push you?
My older sister had also gone into nursing. She was 2 years older. And she wanted to be a physical therapist, and then she changed her mind in her junior year. And she was fortunate enough to get the scholarship that I didn't. And so she never had to worry. She went to nursing school in Brooklyn, New York. And my grandmother lived in Manhattan, so all my sister had to do was go over, and my grandmother gave her. She and my grandmother and my uncle gave her spending money. I wasn't as fortunate. So that's why I said, you know, the driving force to go into the Army was that money during my senior year. And it really gave me the independence that I needed, because you can't cut it very well on $5 a month, and that was all that my parents would send. So that only goes so far.
Not very far.
No.
And so what did they think when you joined the
program? Well, when I first told them that I was going, you know, that I had joined the Army Student Nurse Program, you know, usually my mother was saying, just think of all the men you would meet. That's what I expected out of her. But that wasn't the reaction. Oh, they'll think you're a whore. And I said, what? Oh, you know, they, in terms of WACS. And I said, I'm not joining the Women's Army Corps. I'm joining the Army Nurse Corps. And my father didn't say too much at all then. So, you know, there really wasn't any great communication about that. So
your mom, was she satisfied that you weren't in WAC then and that you were going to the nurse program?
Not really. You know, she really didn't. Because essentially, even when I was, when I came back from Vietnam, I was ETS'd out of the service at Fort Lewis, Washington, and my older sister had paid for my mother to come out to California because my aunt lives in San Jose, and I met them. Well, I ended up there. And she said, were you in a combat zone? I didn't know that. And so, I mean, you know, sometimes I'm just going to say my mother's comprehension left something to be desired. It, you know, many times she would behave childlike, so it was very difficult to really understand what she meant. I think the biggest negative, well, the person that I had to convince most was the director of nursing, because there was a pin that you would wear, and I had a full uniform. We had the dress, the collar, the cuff, the bib, the apron, the whole nine yards there. And so you had to wear that pin while you know, because that was your, essentially, normally the military wants you to show something that you have some sort of affiliation with them or with, you know, your rank. And so the director of nursing was Miss McComas, and I mean, she was, when I had to go down and meet with her, it was really, you know, I mean, it was like going through, you know, being run through the mill. But essentially, you know, I had no problem. Uh-huh. After that, you know, she just wanted to give you a hard time, but she had, you know, difficulty with that. Because two of the assistant director of nursing at the School of Nursing had served in World War II in New Guinea. Mm-hmm. And also one of the instructors, Ms. Pollock and Ms. Ray. So they had been, I mean, under some really harsh conditions. And I think because of that, that the director really had a lot of respect for the military. And so she just wanted, you know, you just don't go and do this without letting me know first. Mm-hmm. But the person who we went in on the buddy program, she, when we didn't end up going on active duty together because she failed a portion of her state board, so she didn't follow me for a year or so.
Uh-huh. What did the recruiter talk to you about when you talked to the recruiter?
Well, the recruiter made it sound very glamorous that we would, you know, where we would get one of our three choices, where we would, you know, when we actually got commissioned, mm-hmm. and that there was, you never, you know, didn't get one of your selection of your duty station. And, of course, then, I'm going to say this, when I received my orders for my assignment just after I was commissioned, just between, I shouldn't say, it probably arrived within 2 days, and it wasn't one of my three choices. It wasn't one of my six choices. And I called them up, and she says, oh, no, you misunderstood me. And I said, oh, no, I didn't. I said, you just didn't quite tell me the truth, that you, if I had joined as a registered nurse, then I would have gotten one of my three choices. But because I joined as a student nurse, hey, uh-huh. You go where you want to. And because I said my choices were I wanted to go to Letterman in San Francisco and Fort Ord in Monterey and I'm trying to think of the name of the hospital at Fort Lewis, Madigan. Those were my choices, and the other one was Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. And they told me I was going to Fort Gordon, Georgia, and I said, where in the world is that? But actually, it was a very good assignment. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, out of, you know, I said the worst thing that can happen to you, it was one of the best, because there we lived in a VOQ. It was an old hospital. It was a Katoman hospital, so it was 4 miles of corridors, and it connected, you know, four ramps, A ramp, B ramp, C ramp, D ramp. So if you had to go to the pharmacy, which was at A1, and in the military, whenever you pick up narcotics, you have to take the narcotic book down there with the prescription. Your ward doctor had to write the prescription, and you had to sign for it at the pharmacy. So, of course, as second lieutenants, you don't have a car. You've got to walk, and they would send you. You had to walk the mile down and the mile back. So it was really, you know, I said the hospital, that was certainly different. But even, you know, we lived in a brand new BOQ, and it was really nice. And I mean, sometimes it was just like living in a college dormitory, because I went to a school of nursing that was, they could only take females, and it was just because you had to live there and you got all your, you got room and board with it. But this was the first time, you know, there I was, you know, exposed to anything that was co-ed, and that was pretty much what the BOQ was. So there were, you met a lot of good people there. And
were there male nurses then?
Yes.
As well?
Mm-hmm. There were Dave Helps, and we were good buddies. There were some of us, because if you were working on nights, then on your days off, you would do things together. And he was, I think there were two warrant officers there. When I was in basic training, that was the last time they took two-year graduates at that time. And they did not come on as officers. They would be what's called a warrant officer, similar to what a lot of the helicopter pilots were, some of the other technical things. So there were, you know, there was just one male nurse in the BOQ, but he was just like, I won't say one of the girls, because that wouldn't be nice, but he was just a really a nice guy. Got along well.
What do you think people thought about him as a male nurse? I mean, mostly females were nurses at that time.
Right. I mean, because you were in the military and you had a lot of male officers, no one, and because of the corpsmen and the ward masters and that were all males, that pretty much all males, that you didn't think anything of it. You know, in a lot of the second lieutenants that lived in the BOQ, they might be MP, infantry, signal. You know, it was just no big deal. Because, like, we went to, we had gotten a weekend, well, actually, we had worked 12 nights and we got 4 days off. And there were three of us, and we drove down to, we thought we were going to Fort Lauderdale, which was beyond the 250-mile limit that you could go. And we ended up in, first we stopped in Jacksonville, Florida, and we had gotten sleeping bags and that from Special Services. So we were camped out on the beach, and this big group of motorcyclists came. So we decided we were going to leave. And we ended up sleeping in the car and driving down to St. Augustine. And so we were all staying there, and there you couldn't sleep on the beach at night. So we had to pool what money we had together to get a motel room. So there were three of us. But going down there, the other nurse, Nancy, she insisted we take her car. It was an automatic Volkswagen, the first ones that they put out, and it broke down. And you don't break down in a small town in Georgia with a foreign car because they can't take care of it. Well, the car broke down again, and we had to call back to one of the other nurses, Rosie, to wire us money. We literally had to have money wired because we couldn't do anything with the car, and we said we've got to put Dave back on the bus because he had to work Monday night. The other, Nancy and I, didn't have to work on Monday night, and so I said it was supposed to be a fun weekend. I said we enjoyed it while it lasted. Truly, you know, so you had some good experiences. So, but that's why I say, you know, it was just like we were all good buddies. It didn't matter that he was a male nurse or anything. I guess I never had any prejudice towards male nurses. I know some nurses who would not work with them, or some who would give them very bad ratings, and which would recall, you know, would result in them not being promoted, or they eventually ended up being rifted out of the service. So, but I never had any trouble.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Georgia?
I was in Georgia for 9 months.
And then did you get orders for Vietnam?
Then I got orders for Vietnam there. Like, I got orders, I guess it was in, it had to be in December. And we had to, you know, I wasn't going to get Christmas off because I was a second lieutenant, so I had to stay there, and I was able to get, I think I had 2 weeks of leave at the last week in January, and then just the 5 days in February before I left from Travis Air Force Base.
Did you volunteer, or were you upset when you got your orders?
No. Well, I'm just going to say a lot of other people were going, and I knew that, you know, probably I would end up being selected, you know, that they wanted to get that first year over with, and since, you know, you had another year to go on that commitment, that, you know, they might as well send you there rather than sending you there after 6 months, having you come back for another assignment. It's just as cheap for them. And also, several of the nurses that I had arrived with there was a group of eight of us that came at the same time for basic training. Four had gotten married. So I said, they weren't going to send the married nurses, but I said the others of us, you know, had a good chance that we might go. So, and because it was, they were going one by one of the nurses who lived in the VOQ with me. So I said, to me, it was just a matter of time. And, you know, they said there were all volunteers there. Well, I didn't actually, I volunteered when I signed up in the Army Student Nurse Program. So it wasn't like you, yes, I went to the command, to the chief nurse and said I wanted to go to Vietnam.
So were you, did you think much about the war before you were ordered to go?
Well, for me, because I was taking care of patients from the Tet Offensive, I had a good idea what was, you know, going on there and what kind of injuries you would see, because I had individuals who had multiple shrapnel wounds, you know, and I mean they had they either had temporary colostomies or permanent colostomies. They were bilateral amputees with a colostomy and a uterostomy, you know, so with some of that, I had already, I had been taking care of them. And some of them, they were my patients for the entire time I was there. But the one rewarding part of that was seeing what they were like and what happened to them when they first came in, and then seeing somebody walking. Maybe he had to have a lift in his shoe to bring that up because he lost part of, you know, some of, he had bone loss in his leg. But to see that he had recovered, his wife came to visit him one time and that was it. You know, divorced him, and to help him cope emotionally with this and to really go on. And the hard part was with I'm just going to say one particular patient. I cared for him on one ward. He ended up on another ward. I ended up there. And he was a bilateral amputee, and he was going to be going to the VA hospital in September of 1968. And it was really hard for me because he said, Lieutenant Burke, when I go there, nobody's going to come to see me. There's only, you know, because at that time, there really pretty much were just old men in the VA system and alcoholics. And that was very hard because he was, you knew he was telling the truth and that was going to happen. And so for me, it's always still, you know, what happened to them? Where are they now?
When was it that you left for Vietnam? Was it
February? I left in February.
69? Mm-hmm. And were you at the 71st year?
Yes. When I came into, in country, into Long Bend, at the replacement center there, they, in February of, I guess, yeah, in February of 1969, they had given some people early outs from Vietnam, and but there weren't supposed to be any medical personnel, but they had already, you know, cut the orders, and there were quite a few so that were leaving, and there weren't replacements coming in. And normally what would happen is you come in that first day to the replacement center, and then the next day that you would go to see the chief nurse of Vietnam. And when I went, I wasn't, you know, they would said normally you would get one of your three choices, and I wasn't given a choice. I was told that I would be going to the 71st Evac Hospital, but first I was going to have to go to Quy Nhon, which was on the coast, to in process. The only problem, you know, I just thought that I had no trouble with that. That was okay. You know, I said, wherever you want to send me, because I was by myself when I came in country. There were no women on the plane. Mm-hmm. So it was all men. Mm-hmm. And they took us out to, after I got that assignment, you know, you got your assignment, that night, or I should say early the next morning, they took us out to what would be the airfield there, and just a corrugated top with a frame, you know, I'm going to say sort of like scaffolding type frame, mm-hmm. and benches. And they're taking us out on a lit bus. This is like 2:30 to 3:30 in the morning, and there was a machine gun jeep in the front and the back. And we get out to the end, but along the roadside, because it is the Vietnamese New Year, you would see the Vietnamese out with candles by these little statues of Buddha, you know, and this was, and you didn't know what was going to happen. And here you are, like, sitting duck in this, you know, I'm just going to say this lit bus. And you get to the airport, and then, you know, I'm going to say there was outgoing, incoming weapons that you could hear. But, I mean, we had no place, like you would say, a bunker. All we could do was get under the benches then once we got to there, because the flight wasn't leaving until 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think these people are insane here. Why did they bring us out in the middle of a night, you know, make us moving targets on this road? Because in terms of that, it makes me think of some of the, you know, the convoys in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, sometimes people just have no common sense. That's what that boiled down to. Mm-hmm. Because I said, you know, they ultimately could have gotten you killed, you know, and it was for no reason, you know, just absolutely none. And that was one of the things there, you know, you're saying, well, how can you tell if it's incoming or outgoing, you know, I'm going to say fire. I said, you know, just give me something to judge it by, you know. I said, I just need a frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Will the outgoing sound like, I said, as if somebody's setting firecrackers off next to my head, or is that with the incoming? And, you know, people would look at you. I said, I just have a need to know. Mm-hmm. And they would just, oh, don't worry. You'll get used to it.
Mm-hmm. What ward did you work in?
I worked on Ward 7, which was when I first got, well, I'm going to say when I first got there, they had me work in the emergency room the first day. Mm-hmm. And then I was sent up to Ward 7 because the head nurse was leaving the next day. And I worked with her the one day. Ward 7 was a medical surgical ward. And then when we had a push with casualties in March and April, then we became a surgical ward, and we weren't set up for that. So we had to equip everything there with that. Because then when the other nurse left, then Diane Carlson Evans became the head nurse on that ward. And one of our ward doctors was a pediatrician, so besides 40 beds and one in the alcove, we also had cribs, isolates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you were responsible for taking care of pediatric patients. And a lot of the nurses didn't have that experience. Uh-huh. So that was different. And for me, because, and I'll say this, that the nursing school where I went to was very good about this. They wanted you to go to a children's hospital for your pediatric training because they felt that in a community hospital you might be exposed to kids maybe with pneumonia, tonsillectomies, appendectomies, that kind of thing. But you wouldn't get the broad base of experience as you would in the children's hospital. So that was invaluable training for me in taking care of the kids. Even though a lot of those children died, and many of them died at night when I was working, I know the doctor thought I was killing his patients. I said, no, that it was, I said, that was, at times that got very hard with that. Because I said, nobody likes to see children die. It doesn't matter what color they are, what faith they are, no matter what. But it still is something that, as an adult, you never like to see children go before you. But when we were a surgical ward, half the ward was American or GI, the other half was Vietnamese. There were some, you know, some wards that wouldn't take Vietnamese patients. The other medical ward, the head nurse on there would not take them, so of course we would have them. But to me it doesn't, you know, I can't distinguish between patients. That whatever, if they're sick, they're sick. If they're injured, they're injured. You just take care of them. You know, to me, it's the same way that when we were K captain nurses training. You took this Florence Nightingale pledge, and I know a lot of people thought it was a lot of bunk in that, but it would be no different to me than a physician taking a Hippocratic oath to do no harm. So, which kind of that.
And did you work nights most of the year?
Most of the year, yeah. So that would be from 7 at night to 7 in the morning.
Uh-huh. Did you like nights?
Well, I would have liked to have worked in the daytime, but you know, that wasn't my choice. You know, I was not the one who made the schedule. The problem became a problem when Diane left in at the end of July. The person who replaced her was a major, and she had only worked OB-GYN, and she didn't want to be there. She said that when she came, she was to go to the third field in Saigon, and she wasn't going to get oriented to the war because she fully intended to go to third field in Saigon, and it didn't happen. So she was not too happy with the first lieutenant orienting her.
Uh-huh.
And I guess you would say, in terms of our philosophy and our patient care manner, you know, very drastically so. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And we reached our culmination on that on Thanksgiving Day. She wanted to talk to me after I'd given them a report, because see, when I take report from her, I would ask many questions and, you know, say, had you called the doctor, had you done this, had you done that? And she did not like to be questioned, but I feel when it's best interest of the patient, I don't care who you are, I'm going to ask you, and I, again, have that need to know. She told me she did not like me. In fact, she hated me. And I made her and the other nurses feel bad because I made the patients like me. And because I did that, they had a hard time with the patients. And I said, this was the first time I'd ever been accused of bribing patients. So, I mean, it was very silly. And what it was when we were medical, a lot of the patients had malaria, and with those high fevers, you need to hydrate them. And, of course, you try and get the fluids into them. You didn't want to necessarily start an IV if you didn't have to. And even at that time, I felt it was an invasive procedure. So I would have my aunt send me Kool-Aid, and I was able to get these. Well, we had wide mouth IV bottles that had, I'm going to say probably about a 1.5-inch diameter. And so the central supply would sterilize them for me. So I had about between 10 and 12 of these bottles, and I had gotten sugar from the mess hall, and at night I would make Kool-Aid, and I would push fluids on patients. And we had, if we could get sodas, we'd sell them for 10 cents. And with that, we were able to buy these sort of vacuum thermos-like pitchers. We got about 10 of those to give to the patients who really needed to push fluid. So with all that, I would do this. And if I didn't think the patient could eat the food that we brought up for breakfast, because you had to serve the patients their meals, and so that was passing out all those trays. We had, with part of our thing about those sodas too, when Diane Carlson went back to the States, we had her buy a 4-slice toaster and send it back. And so we would make toast, and I would keep the jelly, and those were things that would settle your stomach. And so those were the kind of things that she didn't like that I did. So, you know, I mean, in terms of that, she was very difficult. In fact, my last 2 weeks, they closed the ward because the one nurse who was on the ward also became sick with mononucleosis, and they had to medevac her out. So we were reduced with staff, and the other medical ward was down, so we had to move over there. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't even have like a little, you'd say, farewell thing for me on the ward. And the commanding officer told her, that she had to write a commendation for me, and she refused. And he said, "You will sign it. I will write it, and you will sign it." So it was, it was like, she was kicking and screaming, and she was going to have to do it. So it was very difficult in terms of that to cope with that personality. But again, like I said, you know, for me, the patients came first. I didn't care whether she liked me or not. That wasn't any big deal. It was as long as they got taken care of, and in terms of priority of care, that happened. Not making the bed, not that something looked nice, that they were taken care of and they had what they needed. So that was a big deal there.
And what did you do in the days when you were off?
Well, I would, you know, well, what would happen is I would come off nights, have that night off, then I would come on to days to relieve the other person who went on nights, and then come off. What I would do is I would go shopping. That was part of it, and some of it was like going to the Air Force PX. You could walk around. It was like about a mile around on the road and come back. Or in back of us, you could go around to what was the two corps headquarters for the Military Assistance Command to Vietnam. There was a Camp Schmidt, this engineer. I guess it would be like Artillery Hill. It was sort of a battalion there. And it would see, well, did they get Ritz crackers in the can or saltines? That was, you know, I mean, that was a big deal. So that was kind of like that. And Karen, the Red Cross worker, and myself, we found this Vietnamese shop over by what was Artillery Hill. So we would go over there and see what they had. And had, you know, I had an Ao Dai, which was the Vietnamese woman's dress made while I was there, with, you know, just part of that. So a couple of times I went to the Special Forces Hospital, the CIDG, which was for the indigenous, for the Mountain Yards. And the one time, there was a woman there who had given birth, and she was having a hard time breastfeeding, so I could help with that. And had a difficult time, and if baby doesn't suckle and drain the breast, it becomes very painful and uncomfortable. So I had figured out what to do, just using one of these bulb syringes, was just to take it off the one and put it on the other, and it would act just like one of the electric breast pumps. So I was able to do that, and then just put, you know, some ice packs and bind her. And it was something the corpsman that was there wouldn't know how to do, but we just, you know, I knew it from my OB service, so it was, you know. So I said, actually, that was good, you know, to do that. It was something different from what I was doing on the ward. And one time I did go out, with part of that was to, with the Air Force, to one of the Mountaineer villages. So. And I fixed the, in our hooch, we had a wringer washing machine, and it was broke. And since where I grew up, we had a wringer, and I knew that it had to be lint clogging the pump, so I cleaned it out. And when our mama-san came back from having her baby, I showed her how to use the washer and the wringer. So we were the only hooch where we had the washer, because the other ones, they used the basin, and they just used your feet, you know, like somebody would in the olden times down by the river with the rock. And so we were very fortunate. The other thing that I would do, and this was, you know, before I would go to work, is in August, a Catholic chaplain came, Father Flatley, and we had a chapel on our compound, and they didn't hold services there. So he started saying Mass every day at 4 o'clock. So I would go to Mass, and I would do the altar linens for him. And, I mean, it was, I can say I've always had a strong faith, but it was good for me, you know, it was a way of normalizing an abnormal situation. So those are pretty much what I would do. The other thing is I am also from the medevac pilots. I had gotten tile. I tiled my floor, and I painted the room, and I ordered material from Sears Catalog. We did get Sears Catalog there, and so I had drapes. So I said my room was very nice. I mean, you know, it just. Those are the things that kind of help you feel good. So,
and did you stay in nursing after you came
home? I stayed in nursing. When I came back, it was about, if I got back mid-February, because I ETS through Fort Lewis, Washington, so they just kind of dumped me out. I was never counseled about staying on active duty because, again, I was not a four-year graduate. I didn't have a BS. And the Army Nurse Corps was moving to that. That became mandatory in 1974. That to be an Army nurse, you had to. And even ones who were already on active duty, then they really forced them that they had to complete that while they were on there. So anyhow, I went back to Pennsylvania. Well, I should say I went to visit friends and that. And I went out to California at the end of March. And I was looking for jobs. And I wanted a daytime job. I wanted to work Monday through Friday. I didn't want to work nights. So I did a trial thing with an oral surgeon, and I decided he wanted to keep you there until 6:30 at night and come in on Saturday. And I said, nah, this just isn't going to work out. And so I said, at that point in time, I had enough confidence in myself not to try and stick something out. I knew, you know, it was not going to work out, and I just said, sorry, you know, that you just need somebody else who might be more interested in this type of nursing. Because it was starting IVs and, you know, taking out sutures and doing a brief health history and blood pressures and that, and they had this green light system, which I hated. You had to look up to see if the light was on, like you were a robot, and run here, do this, run here, do that, And the other thing was, I did not like to, and I told him this, I do not have anesthesia background. I do not like to give nitrous. I will not give nitrous oxide. You can set it up. I actually had to set up a thing for him to give IV secanol after I had started the IV. And I said, I felt that it was a risky situation. And I just said no. And I ended up, I went to Stanford. But they wanted to put me on a 45-bed ward on the evening shift with one aide, and it was a major surgical unit with overflow for open-heart surgery. I said, I don't think so. And it was just because I had been in the military. They just thought, oh, it'll be a piece of cake for you. So I happened to have had a corneal abrasion, and I went to the ophthalmologist. And he said, I think they need a nurse over here at O'Connor Hospital. I wasn't thinking about working in the emergency room then. And I happened to go over, and I started working evenings there. So I did that for probably almost 3 years. And during that time, I went back to, I started in at a community college, and I would take 6 units each semester along with working evenings. So. The only hard, bad thing about that was no social life. If you didn't socialize with the people you were working with, you were kind of out of a loop. And because I hadn't lived there before, I didn't know a whole lot of people. And I wasn't one to necessarily go to just bars to meet people. That just, to me, was not my style. So, and I decided to move back east then to go back to school full-time. And I ended up in Maryland, going to the University of Maryland. Finished there in 1974. I worked in public health. I love public health. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that's what's helped me is I've worked in a variety of nursing. What I found was happening to me going back when I worked in the emergency room is I was becoming too cynical. This is my emergency room. You will not come in here. If I say so, you can come in here, you know. Mm-hmm. You will do things the way I do. And I said, that wasn't me. I didn't want to be that way. And I said, maybe it's time for a change. And that's when I ended up going back east. And in some respects, it was very good because my father died suddenly in 1974. So I was able to spend some time with him before he died. So I said, which was good because he had mellowed with age. So he had actually improved. And when I was, I graduated and from the University of Maryland, and I worked in public health, and I was able to get a scholarship to the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, did a master's in public health, worked in a family health center, then I was an active duty reservist for 3.5 years, got off the back, came out to California, and worked in public health, and went back and got my in nursing, and I'm working as a nurse practitioner now in occupational health. And I until the time I started at the University of California in September of 1994, I'd been in a troop unit. But I couldn't do that, and because I usually had a lot of responsibilities, and I couldn't do that with school and work also part-time. So I became what's called an individual mobilization augmentee, and I was assigned to a hospital. I wanted to be assigned to Walter Reed so I could go back to visit my friends in Maryland, and I lost my spot. But I did go to Tripler for Army Hospital in Hawaii for 2 weeks, and then I was reassigned to the West Point, to the military academy there, but that didn't last. That got deleted, and I actually spent went to 2 annual trainings at Fort Hood, Texas, with the 4th Infantry Division, which is who I supported in Vietnam. So that was, it was a complete turnaround. I just circled right back around. So that was really nice because, you know, I felt at home there. And that's, pretty much it. I'm in a gray area. I'm a lieutenant colonel. And
did you ever have problems with PTSD or anything like that?
I don't think so. The thing is when I came, because I got off of active duty, people really didn't talk to you about your experience. Nothing was said. And I didn't say anything. I know some people will say in terms of they've never been, exposed to some of the things. But like what I said was I had already been taking care of patients from the Tet Offensive. The other thing is I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. My father was an alcoholic, and when I left home, I felt like I was released from prison. So for me, being in such a dysfunctional family, that wasn't that dysfunctional. There were aspects of it, that you had to do it, but I guess some of it I look at it like it's a job, and, this is part of what goes with the job, and, it's not so great. But the hardest thing for me was the one person that I would have married. We were going to get engaged after he came back to the States, and he died 3 weeks after he came back. So that was very hard for me. August, he died in August, and September and October were very hard. But, because of the patient care, because of doing that job, that helped. It didn't, I'm not going to say it took away all the pain and the sorrow, but the hardest thing for me was I couldn't believe he was dead because I didn't get to go to his funeral. He wasn't a member of my family. He wasn't like my husband or something like that. So I had to stay there. But his family, wrote to me and, told me and how much he talked about me and that. And so when I came back to the States, I went to see them. And I maintained contact with them until they died. But it was that, for me, that was the very hardest thing. But otherwise, I'm going to say that wasn't, something that caused me to have flashbacks. Whenever I would hear a Huey or Iroquois with the medevac, you just look up, you wait. And still some of the things, like if a car backfires, it's something you will jump reflexively, but not quite as much as you did initially. The only thing that I could say was when I first came back, I just had my biorhythms were totally out, and I had a very hard time sleeping. I would not sleep for more than 2 or 3 hours a night. But finally, that worked itself out, too. I just, I'll just say I'm a survivor. I was born at home. I was a breech birth. The fact that I made it out that way. it's one of those things. And even as a kid, But for me, I had two good friends there, my friend Karen and Marcia. We've been friends since. We've kept in touch. We've done things together and all that. And that was very important. And the other thing was after I first got there, the dust-off pilots, these two nurses, the one I replaced and her friend, they took me out with them my first night there, and they were going to be leaving. Mm-hmm. And because these were just like, again, my friends. Because when I grew up as a small kid, there weren't any girls my age. They were all boys. So I was used to having male friends in terms of that. And so that's just what it was like. And for me, you know, after living in the BLQ with them, too, same thing. So. But now, the only time I had problems, I'm going to say with depression, was I had developed uterine cancer, and it was during the summer between my first and second year in the MP program. And I should have just taken the next year off, but they didn't necessarily give it to you. And it was very hard, because I was, you know, recover from surgery, go back to work, go back to school. And it was, you know, I didn't have any reserves. I just wasn't as resilient as I used to be. And I think that was part of it. I always seemed to be able to pick up and go on. But that's worked itself out, too. But I can't say that had anything to do with PTSD.
Any last thoughts? Final thoughts? Final words?
No? You know, I know. I was sitting here when Sam was here, and about her saying that if she had to do it over, she'd do it again. I wouldn't have changed anything in my life the way it's worked out. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll end the interview.
Okay.
Then.